All right, welcome back. Continuing to listen to the weekend edition of the KE Report. And as promised, I am now chatting with Rick Rule, founder of Rule Investment Media. Now, Rick, whenever you speak, I always make sure to have a listen and to really focus on some of the new themes that you're working on. Sometimes you're a bit early to some of the markets, some of the turns, but one of the last times you were on the show, this is before the market turned, you were even talking about moving more into some of the junior stocks, which in all fairness, man, oh man, those were beat down. Those have actually started to turn. The whole sector, resource sector, did start to turn about 2.5 months ago. So now the big question is where I want to start off, and I'm sure something that you're going to be tying into that upcoming Rule Symposium on Natural Resources in Boca Raton back coming up in July is, where are some of the best opportunities in the resource sector that you're seeing right now?
I'm in several different places. The most attractive sector for me are the pre-development stage juniors that have potential tier one deposits. By tier one, I define that arbitrarily as $10 billion in in situ recoverable reserves and resources at current commodity prices, where I get the commodity upside for free. I want the deposit to be potentially in the best cost quartile in its segment in the world, and potentially in the best quartile in terms of return on capital employed, but at any rate, bench scale at least 25% plus return on capital employed. Where you are finding absolute world-class pre-development opportunities in those few commodities that are still out of favor, I think you have the real potential for 10 baggers and 15 baggers. And I think that's particularly attractive. Everybody out there is chasing momentum right now, which means I'm not chasing momentum. I'm trying to, as Gretzky would have said, skate where I think the puck is going, not to where the puck is. I'm also, conversely, at the other end of the spectrum, which is to say, I continue to purchase the BHPs of the world, the Rios of the world, no longer chasing Anglo, but certainly chasing names like ExxonMobil, extremely high-quality companies with 25 or 35 years of resource life that pay very high current yields, but do it after making enough capital expenditure that they will be able to maintain production and continue to pay me those dividends. So I'm in those two places. The third place I'm in pretty aggressively is grassroots exploration, particularly grassroots exploration that is being funded by the prospect generators, by the people who use their intellectual acumen to attract other people's physical capital. But I need to say, I think that absent a global worldwide recession, that there's a lot of places to be in the natural resource business. It just depends on your risk tolerance, your time frame, and how much work you want to be able to put, you want to have to put into your portfolio.
Yeah, fair enough. But hey, look, there is some momentum here. You are right. Some people are chasing momentum. I want to get into these individual areas then. When you talk about these pre-development stage juniors in the best cost quartile, you mentioned, I believe it was 25% return on capital. What other metrics do you look at, and what economic studies, PEA, PFS, feasibility studies, which ones do you focus on? Which ones do you trust?
I trust them all for what they are. A bankable feasibility study has a lot of assumptions. And so you need to equalize across bankable feasibility studies. Some bankable feasibility studies, the best document that you can get, use estimates in terms of capital cost or operating cost that are at a substantial discrepancy to what one would expect in the district. So you have to analyze these things. But I use resource statements like 43-101s to begin to construct my own model. I use preliminary economic assessments as a sort of a target size guide. Obviously, I prefer a pre-feasibility study to a PEA, and I prefer a feasibility study to a pre-feasibility study. But I don't just take the executive summary. I try to do a deep dive. As an example, some gold companies may use a 5% discount, while oil companies may use a 10% discount. That doesn't make any sense to me. I try to equalize my discount because the time value of money is the same, irrespective of what commodity price you use. What's been important to me over time is to understand the reason why something feels anomalously cheap. And that usually has to do with the fact that the country the deposit is domiciled in or the commodity that the company proposes to produce are out of favor or deeply out of favor. While I have on occasion been punished for taking political risk, my willingness to take political risk, or at least ascribed political risk, has made me a lot more money than it's cost me. So I'm willing to apply less rigorous discounts to countries that are perceived to be politically risky than other people are. Or perhaps conversely, I'm not very willing to assign political risk premiums to countries that people, for ethnocentric reasons, believe produce less risk. Similarly, I'm attracted to commodities that are out of favor. If I think that it is more likely than not that the commodity prices in question will move into my favor in the 3 to 5 year time frame, which is perhaps the time frame that will be necessary to put the project into production and the price that they will realize at that point in time. So as an example, I'm a large shareholder of an Australian listed company called Centaurus, which is exploring for a very large nickel and PGM deposit in Brazil. Both nickel and PGMs are out of favor, but I don't expect them to stay out of favor for 5 years. Meanwhile, this deposit will be in the best industry cost quartile and would generate at today's prices, all in sustaining costs, that would give it at least a 25% return on capital employed. The market hates it because there's no momentum, just like the market hated uranium in 2022. Because there was no momentum. I'm attracted to a different Australian issuer called Meteoric, also in Brazil, that is in the rare earths business. People who loved rare earths 4 years ago hate rare earths now because it disappointed. There's no hate as sincere as the hate of a jilted lover. And many resource investors now hate rare earths. Nothing has changed with regards to rare earths. What's changed is the narrative. So I love Tier 1 deposits in out-of-favor or misunderstood substances.
So, Rick, when you're putting together your models here, building out your own models, not just using some of the economic studies that are out there, what do you look for? What do you use in terms of sensitivities, different metals prices, and also how do you go about putting discounts to whatever NPV or other financial metric that you get to figure out the value of a company?
I use a uniform 10% discount, which means that the terminal valuations that I get are much lower than the terminal valuations that you get from Bay Street, which are using 5% or 8% discounts. But I use them across sectors and across companies. I don't use them in a discriminatory fashion. I try to build three case models for pricing: a discount to current market that might be as much as 30% below current commodity prices, a price that's based on the current — by the way, I use the strip, not the spot price when I do that — and then an upside case. So I try to build myself three models so I can understand what I might make, what I might lose, and what would happen if things stayed exactly the same. Importantly, when I'm doing a deep dive into a company and I look at the feasibility study, I try to call people in my network who have a sense about what capital costs really are, who have a sense about what operating costs really are. I have seen estimates, as an example, for operating costs that were as much as 35% lower than the operating costs experienced by producers in the immediate vicinity. And you have to — I'm not trying to say that you have to call the issuer out on this, but you certainly have to understand the reason why they believe that they'll be 35% more efficient than existing producers who have experience with the deposits that they're mining. So it's important that you use each of the preliminary economic assessment, even before that, the resource calculation, the preliminary economic assessment, the pre-feasibility study, and the feasibility study, as screening tools, as tools that bring you into the state of mind where you want to do more work. But it's important to do the work. I will often use investment banks' research, although I ignore the conclusion, but often those people, the analysts, build very, very good economic models. And if I get permission from them to play with their models using my own assumption, it's always easier than generating my own model. And it gives me a better sense of understanding how the investment bank came to the conclusion that they're trying to sell their clients.
Yeah, that's good advice. But it does take the work, right? Dive into those models, ask for those models, and make sure you do actually compare it to other projects, especially in the vicinity. Big question then, how do these companies get funding for these development projects? Because a lot of the time we're seeing CapExes, even just initial CapExes, not the sustaining capital that we're seeing more companies push millions of dollars into, but just the initial CapEx is drastically higher than a company's market cap. How do they go about getting it funded?
A good project will fund itself. It isn't as though there's a shortage of money, although the industry will tell you there's a shortage of money. There's no other way to say it other than in English. It's bullshit. There's a lot of money out there. There is a shortage of really good projects. All of the living legends at my conference, the people who have been serially successful discovering and building mines, will tell you that a good project funds itself. I know, as somebody who writes a check for equity, who writes a check for project debt, who writes a check for mezzanine debt, who writes a check for convertible debentures, that there is way more money out there than there is real silos to contain the money. When the industry tells you that they aren't seeing very much money, what they're saying is that they're not seeing very much dumb money, because there's a lot of smart money out there. Good, viable deposits get built. They get funded.
So do you avoid those deposits that have been around for a long time, where we have heard management say, oh, just next bull market, then we'll get it built? But the fact of the matter is, it's been waiting to be built for years, if not decades.
Depends on how cheap it is. Back in the decade of the 90s, optionality worked very well for me. When we built Lumina Copper with Ross Beaty, when we built Pan American Silver, when we built Silver Standard, you could acquire copper projects or silver projects, or in some cases, gold projects, where tens of millions, sometimes hundreds of millions of dollars had been spent on the project, but the project didn't work at the economics that existed at the time. If you felt that the commodity prices were unnecessarily depressed, in those days, before people invested in optionality, you could buy those deposits literally for pennies on the dollar. What happened is that I and people like me made so much money doing that, that the entry for those deposits, the market capitalization of those marginal deposits, is usually too high to play the game these days. If you do it, you have to do it in a commodity that's deeply out of favor. You had to do it in the uranium space, where the industry average production cost of uranium was $60 a pound, and where they were selling the material for $20 a pound. In other words, you had to buy deposits where there was no psychological satisfaction around buying the deposits, where the deposit or the commodity itself was hated, really, truly hated. One of the things that attracts me to PGMs is they're hated. Nickel is hated. In 2 years, mark my words, Corey, lithium will be hated. Remember, as I said before, there's no hate as sincere as the hate of the jilted lover. And all the people who believed in the lithium print for 5 or 6 years, they will truly hate the lithium business. And you and I will revisit it in 2026. And in 2029, people will say that we were geniuses. That's how you play the optionality game. Most people require psychological gratification. When most people adapt themselves as an example to the uranium narrative, it's after the price of uranium has already gone from $20 a pound to $80 a pound. In other words, the price move in uranium has taken much of the value out of the narrative by the time that people adopt themselves to the narrative. You can't do that. You have to learn to love hate. to play this game.
Oh, Rick, I can't agree with you more, but it can be hard to get into those sectors, especially ones that were down in the dumps for so long, but that's where the best opportunities lie. You also mentioned some of the large majors that you're in. It sounds more in the base metals and energy focus. That actually ties in with the underperformance that we've seen in the gold majors. Is this still just a growth area for you, or is this simply almost a safety, generating yield while also generating potentially some decent capital gains?
The base metals mining company never enjoyed the cheap cost of capital that the gold mining companies did. And the consequence of that is that the base metals mining companies couldn't be as stupid. They're better run businesses. They generate higher returns on capital employed. They exercise more fiscal discipline. They have better balance sheets. Corey, if you observe back in the gold mining business to the decade 2000 to 2010, the gold price went from, if my memory serves me correctly, $255, $260 an ounce, all the way up to almost $1,900 an ounce. A sevenfold move in the product price over 10 years. And the free cash flow per share of the XAU fell. It took real skill to turn a sevenfold increase in the selling price of your product into reducing free cash flow per share. One of the reasons why the gold stocks haven't performed in line with the gold price is because investors have come to believe that they're lousy companies. A different reason, of course, is that the input prices have risen as fast as the gold price has. But in direct answer to your question, I see the premiums being paid for copper cash flow as being substantially less than the premiums paid for gold cash flow. I see the probability of copper cash flow occurring as higher than gold cash flow occurring. And I see managers with track records of financial and technical success, which I seldom see in the gold space. Interestingly, when I buy the larger cap gold companies, I'm not buying the ones with the higher yields, and I'm not buying the ones that are cheaper. I'm buying the Franco-Nevadas, I'm buying the Wheaton Precious, I'm buying the Agnico Eagles. I'm buying the companies that have established track records of capital allocation discipline, of low management expense ratios, and high operating margins.
That's the key, the high operating margin. That's one thing that has held back those gold stocks. But then filter that even lower. You mentioned grassroots exploration. You want some of these prospect generator models, the ones that have majors invested in them. So you do want to follow a little bit where the majors are going. What do you look for in prospect generators? Because there are many more of them right now, and they can be slow to move.
Slow to move works for me. Slow to move could translate into slow to decline, which attracts me. What I like about the prospect generators is they don't dilute. When most speculators look at exploration, they think of it as an asset-intensive business. They want to get themselves excited about a project, a property. I learned in the early 1970s at the University of British Columbia that about 1 in 3,000 mineralized anomalies becomes a mine. So the arithmetic around the juniors, normalized, is that you take a 1 in 3,000 chance for a 10-to-1 return. That makes the BC lottery look like a really good deal. Prospect generators understand that exploration isn't primarily an asset business. It's a knowledge business. It's a technology business, like software development, like biomed. The idea that they don't dilute themselves at the corporate level, they don't dilute your shareholdings in the intellectual capital, but rather dilute at the project level, where the probability is failure, that attracts me to them arithmetically. My track record with them attracts me too. Over 45 years, I've invested in something like 70 prospect generators. I don't know the exact number because I'm over 70 myself. And I have experienced 24 economic discoveries. So my track record of success in the prospect generators is 1 in 3, while the statistical probability of success is 1 in 3,000. I'm attracted to that arithmetic. I'm particularly attracted to that arithmetic because my prospect generators didn't have to dilute themselves in the bad years when everybody else tried to raise money in bad markets to sustain a property where the probability was failure.
So, Rick, do you have a jurisdictional preference or a resource preference when it comes to grassroots exploration in the prospect generator model?
I prefer jurisdictions that other people hate, because I think that the political risk premiums that are assigned to jurisdictions that are perceived as not being risky are wrong. Corey, we'll get some hate for this, but people who look like you and me, which is to say Caucasian males, believe that money stolen from us by white people in English, according to the rule of law through the legislature, is less gone than money stolen from us in other languages in a less formal sense. I assure you, it's not. I wouldn't invest in exploration in British Columbia except on Tahltan land or some other First Nations land where my local stewards were also my partner at all. I don't want to invest in a jurisdiction that would do to me as a mining investor what they did to me as a real estate investor in British Columbia. Most British Columbia residents consider it to be a low-risk jurisdiction because they look like the thieves themselves and perhaps voted for them. My worst experience with political risk came in the jurisdiction I lived in then, which was the People's Republic of California. By contrast, I've been treated extremely well in places like Congo, in places like Sudan, in places like Mali. So I guess political risk is where you find it. Investors who are comfortable with something for some reason seem to believe that Canadian gold is worth more than Brazilian gold or Congolese gold or even Russian gold. Believe me, the gold doesn't care where it comes from. It's only the perception of the investor relative to the reality.
Oh, we've seen a lot of delays, a lot of issues in so-called Tier 1 jurisdictions. So I get where you're coming from there.
Listen to this one, Corey. There's a deposit in Arizona, in copper country, right? In the middle of copper country. It's called Resolution. Average grade 1.5%, a couple billion tons of the stuff. An absolutely world-class deposit. And it's in the midst of infrastructure that was built by copper miners. That deposit's been 25 years in permitting. The net present value of cash flow delayed 25 years is zero.
Yeah, that's a good point there, Rick. But again, unfortunately, that just is this market where even the best jurisdictions can get delayed. And yeah, some of the worst jurisdictions or the so-called worst jurisdictions can offer the best upsides. Look, I know you're active in the financing environment for a lot of the juniors as well. And undoubtedly, we have seen a lot more financings come out. This financing window still remains open. However, I have noticed companies a little skeptical of raising big chunks of money because, well, too much dilution. So they're out there trying to raise a little bit of money. But that turns out to just be lights on money, hoping that they can raise more money in a few months' time. What are you seeing in the financing environment? What are you playing?
The pros are raising money. Look at Frank Giustra with West Red Lake. In a capital-intensive business, if you don't have capital, you don't have a business. You raise what you think is necessary to sustain the company over 2 years, and you raise that money when you can, at the prices that you can obtain. By the way, in the last 12 to 18 months, virtually every financing that I've been attracted to, I've been cut back on. Which is to say the high-quality deals attract lots and lots and lots of capital. The capital dearth that you're talking about is occurring mostly among the flotsam and the jetsam. It amuses me to hear them say that it's dilutive. For most of those companies, any money that they could raise at any price would be accretive. If you talk about the net present value of the assets that they have, which is almost always zero, if the market capitalization is north of zero, the financing is by definition accretive. I haven't seen in this market the need for high quality issuers to give me a warrant. It was customary in the first part of the decade of the 90s for the Lucas Lundins of the world, for the Ross Beatties of the world, for the Bob Quatermains of the world, for the Clive Johnsons of the world, all to attract the capital that they needed to sustain themselves for 2 years or 3 years to have to include a warrant. So, when people talk about the fact that capital is unavailable, what they're really saying is that their ability to communicate the value of their property or their property itself can attract capital.
Yeah, that's a good point. But hey, this financing window is open and everybody's trying to raise money right now. Some are just raising a lot more. Rick, before I get you out of here, let's talk about your conference. July 7th to 11th in Boca Raton, Florida. I'm going to post a link for everyone to sign up. You can either sign up for in-person or for a live stream of the conference. Take us through who's going to be there and why people should attend.
First of all, the conference has stood the test of time. It's been around about 30 years, Corey. I don't know exactly how long, which means that we have delivered for our attendees for a very, very long time. How do we do that? We have great big picture thinkers. The Jim Rickards of the world, the Daniela DiMartino Booths, the Nomi Prinzes, the Grant Williams, the Bill Bonners of the world. People who tell you about the world the way it really is, not the way the CBC wishes it was. Once we've helped you with your worldview, we bring analysts and portfolio managers who have been successful in natural resources for 30 years. Not people who failed in crypto and failed with pot, but really people who have made money where the rubber meets the road in resources for a very, very, very long time. Probably more importantly than that, Corey, we introduce you to the living legends, mining entrepreneurs who have built multi-billion dollar companies from scratch, talking about how they did it, the lessons that they learned, and how those lessons made them a better investor and can make you a better investor too. I had an email 3 years ago from an attendee who said, following Robert Friedland around the exhibit floor, watching what booths he stopped in front of and occasionally listening to the questions that he asked of exhibitors was worth the cost of admission. He got the whole rest of the conference for free. You get that with the Living Legends. Beyond the Living Legends, every exhibitor at the conference is vetted. Every single public company exhibitor in the conference is owned in my accounts or in accounts managed by myself. Now, there's no guarantee because I own a stock that it goes up, but there is a guarantee that unlike any other investment conference I know of on the planet, every single exhibitor is vetted. Also, the conference is taped. Whether you attend live or live stream, you'll have the ability to play the transcripts of the conference again and again and again. And that's important because we're going to give you 50 or 60 hours of intense programming over 4 days. There's no way in the world that you can absorb all that information in real time. All of that together, Corey, allows me to tell your viewers this. Whether you attend in person or whether you attend live stream, if you don't think that the information that we have given you is worth the price that we paid, you have a gold-plated money-back guarantee. Just email me. Say, I didn't get my money's worth, and I'll give you your money back. Now, in 30 or so years of making these guarantees, I've only had to refund about 0.1% of the fees charged. But the truth is, we have enough faith in our product, born of 30 years of producing that product, that we can offer people an absolute gold-plated money-back guarantee. By the way, the discounted admission to the conference ends on the 15th of May, which is to say midnight tomorrow night. If you care to avail yourself of the money-back guarantee, absolutely positively, act now.
All right, Rick, thank you so much for taking time with us. I always find our conversations very insightful, and it's quite encouraging seeing all the opportunities that you still see out there. But again, being still selective and also doing your own due diligence, not just listening to what the companies are saying or what other newsletter writers or promotional sources are saying. Wealth and knowledge, as always, Rick, and I will post a link to the Rural Investment Media website.
I might say that if your listeners like my due diligence, they can access a little of it for free. Go to ruralinvestmentmedia.com, list your natural resource stocks. I'll personally rank them 1 to 10. No charge, no obligation. Ruleinvestmentmedia.com, list your resource stocks. Please no crypto, please no pot stocks, please no tech stocks. Leave an old man to do what he does well.
Hey, I appreciate that. You offered it last time, Rick. So again, click that link below to find out more about the conference. And also go to Rule Investment Media where you can list those stocks for Rick to share his thoughts on. Rick, thank you for your time, everybody. Thanks for tuning in to this weekend show. Please be sure to visit our website, podcast, and YouTube channel. for all our daily editorials and company updates. And as always, keep in touch with me through email. I love hearing from each and every one of you. I hope you all have a great rest of your weekend.
Thank you, sir.
For our upcoming appearance schedule, visit kereport.com. The Corlin Economics Report will be back in just a moment.